"No, Sergeant," I said as if to a small child. "She won't be coming back. She's being taken for interrogation. Just forget about her." I closed the hatch. But as Schneider spun the shuttle upward, I peered out of the viewport and saw him still standing there, buffeted by the storm of our departure. He didn't even bother to shield his face from the dust. Chapter 4. We flew west from the camp on Grav Effect, over a mixture of desert scrub and blots of darker vegetation where the planet's flora had managed to get a lock on shallow-running aquifers. About 20 minutes later, we picked up the coast and headed out to sea over waters that Wedge Military Intelligence said were infested with Kempist smart mines. Schneider kept our speed down, subsonic the whole time. Easy to track. I spent the early part of the flight in the main cabin, ostensibly going through a current affairs data stack that the shuttle was pulling down from one of Carrera's command satellites, but in reality, watching Tanya Wardani with an envoy-tuned eye. She sat slumped in the seat farthest from the hatch, and hence closest to the right-side viewports, forehead resting against the glass. Her eyes were open, but whether she was focusing on the ground below was hard to tell. I didn't try to speak to her. I'd seen the same mask on 1,000 other faces this year, and I knew she wasn't coming out from behind it until she was ready, which might be never. Wardani had donned the emotional equivalent of a vacuum suit, the only response left in the human armory when the moral parameters of the outside environment have grown so outrageously variable that an exposed mind can no longer survive unshielded. Lately, they've been calling it war shock syndrome, an all-encompassing term that bleakly but rather neatly puts the writing on the wall for those who would like to treat it. There may be a plethora of more or less effective psychological techniques for repair, but the ultimate aim of any medical philosophy, that of prevention rather than cure, in this case clearly beyond the wit of humanity to implement. To me it comes as no surprise that we're still flailing around with Neanderthal spanners in the elegant wreckage of Martian civilization without really having a clue how all that ancient culture used to operate. After all, you wouldn't expect a butcher of farm livestock to understand or be able to take over from a team of neurosurgeons. There's no telling how much irreparable damage we may have already caused to the body of knowledge and technology the Martians have unwisely left lying around for us to discover. In the end, we're not much more than a pack of jackals, nosing through the broken bodies and wreckage of a plane crash.
"Coming up on the coast,"
Schneider's voice said over the intercom.
"You want to get up here?"
I lifted my face away from the holographic data display, flattened the data motes to the base, and looked across at Wardani. She had shifted her head slightly at the sound of Schneider's voice, but the eyes that found the speaker set in the roof were still dulled with emotional shielding. It hadn't taken me very long to extract from Schneider the previous circumstances of his relationship with this woman, but I still wasn't sure how that would affect things now. On his own admission, it had been a limited thing, abruptly terminated by the outbreak of war almost 2 years ago, and there was no reason to suppose it could cause problems. My own worst-case scenario is that the whole starship story was an elaborate con on Schneider's part for no other purpose than to secure the archaeologues' release and get the two of them off-world. There had been a previous attempt to liberate Wardani, if the camp commandant was to be believed, and part of me wondered if those mysteriously well-equipped commandos hadn't been Schneider's last set of dupes in the bid to reunite him with his partner. If that turned out to be the case, I was going to be angry. Inside me, at the level where it really mattered, I didn't give the idea much credence. Too many details had checked out in the time since we'd left the hospital. Dates and names were correct. There had been an archaeological dig on the coast northwest of Sauberville, and Tanya Wardani was registered as site regulator. The Hollage liaison was listed as Guild Pilot Ian Mendel, but it was Schneider's face, and the hardware manifest began with the serial number and flight records of a cumbersome Maui 10 series suborbital. Even if Schneider had tried to get Wardani out before, it was for far more material reasons than simple affection. And if he hadn't, then somewhere along the line someone else had been dealt into this game. Whatever happened, Schneider would bear watching. I closed down the data display and got up, just as the shuttle banked seaward, steadying myself with a hand on the overhead lockers. I looked down at the archaeolog. "I'd fasten my seatbelt if I were you. The next few minutes are likely to be a little rough." She made no response, but her hands moved in her lap. I made my way forward to the cockpit. Schneider looked up as I entered, hands easy on the arms of the manual flight chair. He nodded at a digital display that he'd maximized near the top of the instrument projection space.
"Depth counter's still at less than 5 meters. Bottom shelves out for kilometers before we hit deep water. You sure those fuckers don't come in this close?"
"If they were in this close, you'd see them sticking out of the water," I said, taking the co-pilot's seat. "Smart Mine's not much smaller than a Marauder bomb. Basically an automated mini-sub. You got the set online?"
"Sure, just mask up. Weapon systems on the right arm."
I slid the elasticized gunner's eye mask down over my face and touched the activate pads at the temples. A seascape in bright primaries wrapped around my field of vision, pale blue shaded deeper gray with the landscape of the seabed beneath. Hardware came through in shades of red, depending on how much it corresponded to the parameters I'd programmed in earlier. Most of it was light pink in color, inanimate alloy wreckage devoid of electronic activity. I let myself slide forward into the virtual representation of what the shuttle's sensors were seeing, forced myself to stop actively looking for anything, and relaxed the last mental millimeters into the Zen state. Mindsweeping was not something the Envoy Corps taught us as such, but the total poise that only comes, paradoxically, with an utter lack of expectation was vital to the Corps training. A protectorate envoy, deployed as digitized human freight via hyperspatial needlecast, could expect to wake up to literally anything. At the very least, you habitually find yourself in unfamiliar bodies on unfamiliar worlds where people are shooting at you. Even on a good day, no amount of briefing can prepare you for a total change of environment like that. And in the invariably unstable to lethally dangerous sets of circumstances the envoys have been created to deal with, there just isn't any point. Virginia Vidora, Corps trainer, hands in the pockets of her coveralls, looking us over with calm speculation. Day one induction. "Since it is logistically impossible to expect everything," she told us evenly, "we will teach you not to expect anything. That way, you will be ready for it." I didn't even consciously see the first smart mine. There was a red flare in the corner of one eye, and my hands had already matched coordinates and loosed the shuttle's hunter-killer micros. The little missiles ran green traces across the virtual seascape, plunged beneath the surface like sharp knives in flesh, and pricked the squatting mine before it could either move or respond. Flash blast of detonation, and the surface of the sea heaved upward like a body on an interrogation table. Once upon a time, men had to run their weapon systems all by themselves. They went up in the air in flyers not much bigger or better equipped than bathtubs with wings, and fired off whatever clumsy hardware they could squeeze into the cockpit with them. Later, they designed machines that could do the job faster and more accurately than humanly possible, and for a while it was a machine's world up there. Then the emerging biosciences began to catch up, and suddenly the same speed and precision capacity was available as a human option again. Since then, it's been a race of sorts between technologies to see which can be upgraded faster, the external machines or the human factor. In that particular race, Envoy psychodynamics were a sharp surprise sprint up the inside lane. There are war machines that are faster than me, but we weren't lucky enough to have one aboard. The shuttle was a hospital auxiliary, and its strictly defensive weaponry ran to the micro-turret in the nose, and a decoy and evade package that I wouldn't have trusted to fly a kite. We were going to have to do this ourselves.
"One down. The rest of the pack won't be far away. Kill your speed. Get us down on the deck and arm the tinsel."
They came from the west, scuttling across the seabed like fat-bodied cylindrical spiders, drawn to the violent death of their brother. I felt the shuttle tip forward as Schneider brought us down to barely 10 meters in altitude, and the solid thump as the tinsel bomb racks deployed.
My eyes flickered across the mines, 7 of them converging. They usually ran 5 to a pack, so this had to be the remnants of 2 groups, though who'd thinned their numbers out so much was a mystery to me. From what I'd read in the reports, there'd been nothing in these waters but fishing boats since the war began. The seabed was littered with them. I acquired the lead mine and killed it almost casually. As I watched, the first torpedoes erupted from the other 6 and rose through the water toward us.
"They're on us!"
"Seeing them?"
Schneider said laconically, and the shuttle flinched into an evasive curve. I peppered the sea with micros on auto-seek. Smart mine is a misnomer. They're actually pretty stupid. It stands to reason. They're built for such a narrow range of activity, it isn't advisable to program in much intellect. They attach themselves to the seabed with a claw for launch stability, and they wait for something to pass overhead. Some can dig themselves deep enough to hide from spectroscanners. Some camouflage themselves as seabed wreckage. Essentially, they're a static weapon. On the move, they can still fight, but their accuracy suffers. Better yet, their mines have a dogmatic either-or target acquisition system that tags everything surface or airborne before it fires on it. Against air traffic, it uses surface-to-air micros. Against shipping, the torpedoes. The torpedoes can convert to missile mode at a pinch, shedding their propulsion systems at surface level and using crude thrusters to get aloft, but they're slow. At nearly surface level, and throttled back almost to hovering, we'd been made out as a ship. The torpedoes came up for air in our shadow, found nothing, and the auto-seek micros destroyed them while they were still trying to shrug off their underwater drives. Meanwhile, the spread of micros I'd launched sought and destroyed 3 of the mines. At this rate, malfunction, malfunction, malfunction. The fail light pulsed in the upper left field of my vision, details scrolling down. I had no time to read it. The fire controls were dead in my hands, jammed solid, the next 2 micros unarmed in their launch cradles. Fucking mothballed UN surplus flashing through my mind like a falling meteor. I slammed the emergency auto-repair option. The shuttle's rudimentary troubleshooter brain leapt down into the jammed circuits. No time. It could take whole minutes to fix. The remaining 3 mines launched surface-to-air at us.
Shh!
Schneider, whatever his other failings, was a good flyer. He flung the shuttle on its tail before the syllable was out of my mouth. My head snapped back against the seat as we leapt into the sky, trailing a swarm of surface-to-air missiles.
"I'm jammed."
"I know," he said tautly.
"Tensile them,"
I yelled, competing with the proximity alerts that screamed in my ears. The altitude numerals flashed over the kilometer mark.
"On it."
The shuttle boomed with the tensil bomb's launch. They detonated 2 seconds in our wake, sowing the sky with tiny electronic appetizers. The surface-to-air fire spent itself among the decoys. On the weapons board at the side of my vision, a cleared light flashed green, and as if to prove the point, the launcher executed its last jammed command and launched the 2 waiting micros into the targetless space ahead of us. Beside me, Schneider whooped and spun the shuttle about. With the high maneuver fields belatedly compensating, I felt the turns slop through my guts like choppy water, and had time to hope that Tanya Wardani hadn't eaten recently. We hung for an instant on the wings of the shuttle's AG fields, then Schneider killed the lift, and we plunged a steep line back toward the surface of the sea. From the water, a second wave of missiles rose to meet us.
"Tensil!"
The bomb racks banged open again, sighting on the 3 undamaged mines below. I emptied the shuttle's magazines and hoped. Breath held back. The micros launched clean. At the same moment, Schneider threw on the grav fields again, and the little vessel shuddered from end to end. The tinsel bombs, now falling faster than the crash-reversed shuttle that had launched them, exploded fractionally ahead of and below us. My virtual vision flooded with crimson sleet from the storm of decoy broadcast, and then the explosions of the surface-to-air missiles as they destroyed themselves amid it. My own micros were away, fired through the tiny window of opportunity before the tinsel blew, and locked onto the mine somewhere below. The shuttle spiraled down behind the debris of tinsel and mislead missiles. Scant moments before we hit the surface of the sea, Schneider fired one more carefully doctored pair of tinsel bombs. They detonated just as we slipped below the waves.
"We're under," said Schneider.
On my screen, the pale blue of the sea deepened as we sank, nose down. I twisted around, searching for the mines, and found only a satisfying array of wreckage. I let out the last breath I'd drawn somewhere up in the missile-strewn sky and rolled my head back in the seat. "That," I said to no one in particular, "was a mess." We touched bottom, stuck for a moment, and then drifted fractionally upward again. Around us, the shrapnel from the doctored tinsel bomb settled slowly to the seabed. I studied the pink fragments with care and smiled. I'd packed the last two bombs myself. Less than an hour's work the night before we came to get Wardani. But it had taken 3 days reconnoitering deserted battle zones and bombed-out landing fields to gather the necessary pieces of hull casing and circuitry to fill them. I peeled off the gunner's mask and rubbed my eyes. "How far off are we?" Schneider did something to the instrument display.
"About 6 hours, maintaining this buoyancy. If I helped the current along with the grabs, we could do it in half that."
"Yeah, and we could get blown out of the water, too. I didn't go through the last 2 minutes for target practice. You keep the fields banked all the way, and use the time to figure out some way to wipe the face off this bucket." Schneider gave me a mutinous look.
"And what are you going to be doing all this time?"
"Repairs," I said shortly, heading back for Tanya Wardani. Chapter 5. The fire threw leaping shadows, making her face into a camouflage mask of light and dark. It was a face that might have been handsome before the camp swallowed her, but the rigors of political internment had left it a gaunt catalogue of bones and hollows. The eyes were hooded, the cheeks sunken. Deep inside the wells of her gaze, firelight glittered on fixed pupils. Stray hair fell across her forehead like straw. One of my cigarettes slanted between her lips, unlit.
"You don't want to smoke that?"
I asked after a while. It was like talking on a bad satellite link, a 2-second delay before the glitter in her eyes shifted upward to focus on my face. Her voice ghosted out, rusty with disuse.
"What?"
"The cigarette. Sight sevens. Best I could get outside landfall." I handed the pack across to her, and she fumbled it, turning it over a couple of times before she found the ignition patch and touched it to the end of the cigarette in her mouth. Most of the smoke escaped and was carried away on the soft breeze, but she took some down and grimaced as it bit.
"Thanks,"
she said quietly, and held the packet in cupped hands, looking down at it as if it were a small animal she had rescued from drowning. I smoked the rest of my own cigarette in silence, gaze flickering along the tree line above the beach. It was a programmed wariness, not based on any real perception of danger, the envoy analog of a relaxed man beating time to music with his fingers. In the envoys, you're aware of potential hazards in the surroundings the way most people are aware that things will fall out of their hands if they let them go. The programming goes in at the same instinctual level. You don't let down your guard ever, any more than a normal human being would absent-mindedly let go of a filled glass in midair.
"You've done something to me."
It was the same low voice she had used to thank me for the cigarette. But when I dropped my gaze from the trees to look at her, something had kindled in her eyes. She was not asking me a question.
"I can feel it,"
she said, touching the side of her head with splayed fingers.
"Here. It's like opening."
I nodded, feeling cautiously for the right words. On most worlds I've visited, going into someone's head uninvited is a serious moral offense, and only government agencies get away with it on a regular basis. There was no reason to assume the Latimer sector, Sanction 4, or Tanya Wardani would be any different. Envoy co-option techniques make rather brutal use of the deep wells of psychosexual energy that drive humans at a genetic level. Properly mined, the matrix of animal strength on tap in those places will speed up psychic healing by whole orders of magnitude. You start with light hypnosis, move into quick-fix personality engagement, and thence to close bodily contact that only misses definition as sexual foreplay on a technicality. A gentle, hypnotically induced orgasm usually secures the bonding process. But at the final stage with Ordani, something had made me pull back. The whole process was uncomfortably close to a sexual assault as it was. On the other hand, I needed Ordani in one psychic piece, and under normal circumstances that would have taken months, maybe years to achieve. We didn't have that kind of time. It's a technique, I offered tentatively. A healing system. I used to be an envoy. She drew on her cigarette.
I thought the envoys were supposed to be killing machines.
That's what the Protectorate wants you to think. Keeps the colonies scared at a gut level. The truth is a lot more complex, and ultimately it's a lot more scary when you think it through. I shrugged. Most people don't like to think things through. Too much effort. They'd rather have the edited visceral highlights.
Really? And what are those?
I felt the conversation gathering itself for flight, and leaned forward to the heat of the fire. Sharya, Adarasion, the big bad high-tech envoys riding in on hypercast beams and decanting into state-of-the-art biotech sleeves to crush all resistance. We used to do that too, of course, but what most people don't realize is that our five most successful deployments ever were all covert diplomatic postings, with barely any bloodshed at all. Regime engineering. We came and went, and no one even realized we'd been there.
You sound proud of it.
I'm not. She looked at me steadily.
Hence the used to?
Something like that.
So how does one stop being an envoy?
I was wrong. This wasn't conversation. Tanya Ordani was sounding me out.
Did you resign? Or did they throw you out?
I smiled faintly. I'd really rather not talk about it if it's all the same to you.
You'd rather not talk about it?
Her voice never rose, but it splintered into sibilant shards of rage.
God damn you, Kovac. Who do you think you are? You come to this planet with your fucking weapons of mass destruction and your profession of violence airs, and you think you're going to play the injured child inside with me? Fuck you and your pain. I nearly died in that camp. I watched other women and children die. I don't fucking care what you went through. You answer me. Why aren't you with the envoys anymore?
The fire crackled to itself. I sought out an ember in its depths and watched it for a while. I saw the laser light again, playing against the mud in Jimmy DeSoto's ruined face. I'd been to this place in my mind countless times before, but it never got any better. Some idiot once said that time heals all wounds, but they didn't have envoys back when that was written down. Envoy conditioning carries with it total recall, and when they discharge you, you don't get to give it back. Have you heard of Inanen? I asked her.
Of course.
It was unlikely she hadn't. The Protectorate doesn't get its nose bloodied very often, and when it happens, the news travels, even across interstellar distances.
You were there?
I nodded.
I heard everybody died in the viral strike.
Not quite. Everybody in the second wave died. They deployed the virus too late to get the initial beachhead, but some of it leaked over through the communications net, and that fried most of the rest of us. I was lucky. My comlink was down.
You lost friends?
Yes.
And you resigned?
I shook my head. I was invalided out. Psych profiled unfit for envoy duties.
I thought you said your comlink...
The virus didn't get me. The aftermath did. I spoke slowly, trying to keep a lock on the remembered bitterness. There was a court of inquiry. You must have heard about that, too.
They indicted the High Command, didn't they?
Yeah, for about 10 minutes. Indictment quashed. That's roughly when I became unfit for envoy duties. You might say I had a crisis of faith.
Very touching.
She sounded abruptly tired, the previous anger too much for her to sustain.
Pity it didn't last, huh?
I don't work for the Protectorate anymore, Tanya. Wardani gestured.
That uniform you're wearing says otherwise.
This uniform? I fingered the black material with distaste. Is strictly a temporary thing.
I don't think so, Kovac.
Schneider's wearing it too, I pointed out.
Schneider.
The name gusted out of her doubtfully. She obviously still knew him as Mendel.
Schneider is an asshole.
I glanced down the beach to where Schneider was banging about in the shuttle with what seemed like an inordinate degree of noise. The techniques I'd used to bring Wardani's psyche back to the surface hadn't gone down well with him, and he liked it even less when I told him to give us some time alone by the fire. Really? I thought you and he...
Well...
She considered the fire for a while.
He's an attractive asshole.
Did you know him before the dig? She shook her head.
Nobody knew anybody before the dig. You just get assigned and hope for the best.
You got assigned to the Dangrak Coast? I asked casually.
No.
She drew in her shoulders as if against cold.
I'm a guildmaster. I could have gotten work on the plains digs if I'd wanted to. I chose Dangrak. The rest of the team were assigned scratchers. They didn't buy my reasons, but they were all young and enthusiastic. I guess even a dig with an eccentric's better than no dig at all.
And what were your reasons? There was a long pause, which I spent cursing myself silently for the slip. The question had been genuine. Most of my knowledge of the Archaeologue Guild was gleaned from popular digests of their history and occasional successes. I had never met a guildmaster before, and what Schneider had to say about the dig was obviously a filtered version of Bordani's pillow talk, stepped on by his own lack of deeper knowledge. I wanted the full story, but if there was one thing that Tanya Wardani had seen a surplus of during her internment, it was probably interrogation. The tiny increment of incisiveness in my voice must have hit her like a marauder bomb. I was marshaling something to fill the silence when she broke it for me in a voice that only missed being steady by a micron.
You're after the ship? Mende...
She started again.
Schneider told you about it?
Yeah, but he was kind of vague. Did you know it was going to be there?
Not specifically, but it made sense. It had to happen sooner or later. Have you ever read Wysinski?
Heard of him. Hub theory, right? She allowed herself a thin smile.
Hub theory isn't Wysinski's. It just owes him everything. What Wysinski said, among others at the time, is that everything we've discovered about the Martians so far points to a much more atomistic society than our own. You know, winged and carnivorous, originally from airborne predator stock, almost no cultural traces of pack behavior.
The words started to flow, conversational patterns fading out as the lecturer in her tuned in unconsciously.
That suggests the need for a much broader personal domain than humans require, and a general lack of sociability. Think of them as birds of prey, if you like, solitary and aggressive. That they built cities at all is evidence that they managed, at least in part, to overcome the genetic legacy, maybe in the same way humans have gotten a halfway lock on the xenophobic tendencies that pack behavior has given us. Where Wysinski differs from most of the experts is in his belief that this tendency would only be repressed to the extent that it was sufficiently desirable to group together, and that with the rise of technology, it would be reversible. You still with me?
Just don't speed up. In fact, I wasn't having a problem, and some of this more basic stuff I'd heard before in one form or another. But Wardani was relaxing visibly as she talked, and the longer that went on, the better the chance there was of her recovery remaining stable. Even during the brief moments it had taken her to launch into the lecture,
She had grown more animated, hands gesturing, face intent rather than distant. A fraction at a time, Tanya Wardani was reclaiming herself.
You mentioned hub theory. That's a bullshit spinoff. Fucking Carter and Bogdanovich whoring off the back of Wysinski's work on Martian cartography. See, one of the things about Martian maps is there are no common centers. No matter where the archaeologue teams went on Mars, they always found themselves at the center of the maps they dug up. Every settlement put itself slap in the middle of its own maps, always the biggest blob, regardless of actual size or apparent function. Wysinski argued that this shouldn't surprise anybody, since it tied in with what we'd already surmised about the way Martian minds worked. To any Martian drawing a map, the most important point on that map was bound to be where the map major was located at the time of drawing. All Carter and Bogdanovich did was to apply that rationale to the astrogation charts. If every Martian city considered itself the center of a planetary map, then every colonized world would in turn consider itself the center of the Martian hegemony. Therefore, the fact that Mars was marked big and dead center on all these charts meant nothing in objective terms. Mars might easily be a recently colonized backwater, and the real hub of Martian culture could be literally any other speck on the chart.
She pulled a disdainful face.
That's hub theory.
You don't sound convinced. Wardani plumed smoke into the night.
I'm not. Like Wysinski said at the time, so fucking what? Carter and Bogdanovich completely missed the point. By accepting the validity of what Wysinski said about Martian spatial perceptions, they should have also seen that the whole concept of hegemony was probably outside Martian terms of reference.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
The thin smile again, more forced this time.
That's where it started to get political. Wysinski went on record with that, saying that wherever the Martian race had originated, there was no reason to suppose that the mother world would be accorded any more importance in the scheme of things than, quote, absolutely essential in matters of basic factual education, unquote.
Mummy, where do we come from? That sort of thing.
That sort of thing exactly. You might point it out on the map. That's where we all came from once. But since where we are now is far more important in real day-to-day terms, that's about as far as the Mother World homage would ever get.
I don't suppose Wysinski ever thought to disown this view of things as intrinsically and irreconcilably inhuman, did he? Wardani gave me a sharp look.
How much do you really know about the Guild, Kovach?
I held up finger and thumb a modest span apart. Sorry, I just like to show off. I'm from Harlan's world. Minoru and Gretzky went to trial about the time I got into my teens. I was in a gang. Standard proof of how antisocial you were was to carve air graffiti about the trial in a public place. We all had the transcripts by heart. Intrinsically and irreconcilably inhuman came up a lot in Gretzky's recantation. Seems like it was the standard guild statement for keeping your research grants intact. She lowered her gaze.
It was. For a while. And no, Wysinski wouldn't play that tune. He loved the Martians, he admired them, and he said so in public. That's why you only hear about him in connection with fucking hub theory. They pulled his funding, suppressed most of his findings, and gave it all to Carter and Bogdanovich to run with. And what a blowjob those two whores gave in return. The UN Commission voted a 7% increase in the Protectorate's strategic budget the same year, all based on paranoid fantasies of a Martian overculture somewhere out there, waiting to jump us.
Neat.
Yeah, and totally impossible to disprove. All the astrogation charts we've recovered on other worlds bear out Wysinski's finding. Each world centers itself on the map the way Mars did, and that single fact is used to scare the UN into keeping a high strategic budget and a tight military presence across the whole protectorate. No one wants to hear about what Wysinski's research really means, and anybody who talks too loud about it or tries to apply the findings and research of their own is either defunded overnight or ridiculed, which in the end comes to the same thing.
She flicked her cigarette into the fire and watched it flare up. That what happened to you? I asked.
Not quite.
There was a palpable click to the last syllable, like a lock turning. Behind me, I could hear Schneider coming up the beach, his checklist for the shuttle, or maybe just his patience, exhausted. I shrugged. Talk about it later if you want to.
Maybe. How about you tell me what all that macho high-G maneuver bullshit was today?
I glanced up at Schneider as he joined us beside the fire. Hear that? Complaint about the in-flight entertainment.
Fucking passengers,
Schneider grunted, picking up the clowning cue flawlessly as he lowered himself to the sand.
Nothing ever changes.
You gonna tell her, or shall I?
Was your idea. Got a 7?
Wardani held up the pack, then tossed them into Schneider's grasp. She turned back to me.
Well?
The Dangrik Coast, I said slowly, whatever its archaeological merits may have been, is part of the Northern Rim territories, and the Northern Rim has been designated by Carrera's Wedge as one of 9 primary objectives in winning the war. And judging from the amount of organic damage going on up there at the moment, the Kempists have come to the same conclusion.
So?
So mounting an archaeological expedition while Kemp and the Wedge are up there fighting for territorial dominance isn't my idea of smart. We have to get the fighting diverted.
Diverted?
The disbelief in her voice was gratifying to hear. I played to it, shrugging again. Diverted or postponed, whatever works. The point is we need help, and the only place we're going to get help of that order is from the corporates. We're going to landfall, and since I'm supposed to be on active service, Schneider's a Kempis deserter, you're a prisoner of war, and this is a stolen shuttle, we need to shed a little heat before we do that. Satellite coverage of our little run-in with the smart minds back there will read like they took us down. A search of the seabed will show up pieces of wreckage compatible with that. Allowing that no one looks at the evidence too closely, we'll be filed as missing, presumed vaporized, which suits me fine.
You think they'll let it go at that?
Well, it's a war. People getting killed shouldn't raise too many eyebrows. I picked a stray length of wood out of the fire and started tracing a rough continental map in the sand. Oh, they may wonder what I was doing down here when I'm supposed to be taking up a command on the rim, but that's the kind of detail that gets sifted in the aftermath of a conflict. Right now, Carrera's Wedge are spread pretty thin in the north, and Kemp's forces are still pushing them toward the mountains. They've got the Presidential Guard coming in on this flank. I prodded at the sand with my makeshift pointer. And sea-launched airstrikes from Kemp's iceberg fleet over here. Carrera's got a few more important things to worry about than the exact manner of my demise.
And you really think the cartel are going to put all that on hold just for you?
Tanya Wardani swung her burning gaze from my face to Schneider's.
You didn't really buy into this, did you, Jan?
Schneider made a small gesture with one hand.
Just listen to the man, Tanya. He's jacked into the machine. He knows what he's talking about. Yeah, right.
The intense, hectic eyes snapped back to me.
Don't think I'm not grateful to you for getting me out of the camp, because I am. I don't think you can imagine quite how grateful I am. But now that I'm out, I'd quite like to live. This plan is all bullshit. You're just going to get us killed, either in landfall by corporate samurai, or caught in the crossfire at Dangrik. They aren't going to...
You're right, I said patiently, and she shut up, surprised. To a point, you're right. The major corporates, the ones in the cartel, they wouldn't give the scheme a second glance. They can murder us, stick you into virtual interrogation until you tell them what they want to know, and then just keep the whole thing under wraps until the war is over and they've won.
If they win.
They will, I told her. They always do, one way or the other. But we aren't going to the majors. We've got to be smarter than that. I paused and poked at the fire, waiting. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw how Schneider craned forward with tension. Without Tanya Wardani aboard, the whole thing was dead in the water, and we all knew it. The sea whispered itself up on the beach and back. Something popped and crackled in the depths of the fire.
All right.
She moved slightly, like someone bedridden, shifting to a less aching posture.
Go on. I'm listening.
Relief gusted out of Schneider audibly. I nodded. This is what we do. We target one corporate operator in particular, one of the smaller, hungrier ones. It might take a while to sound out, but it shouldn't be difficult. And once we have the target, we make them an offer they can't refuse. A one-time-only, limited-period, bargain-basement-satisfaction-guaranteed purchase. I saw the way she exchanged glances with Schneider. Maybe it was all the monetary imagery that made her look to him.
Small and hungry as you like, Kovac, you're still talking about a corporate player.
Her eyes locked onto mine.
Planetary wealth. And murder and virtual interrogation are hardly expensive. How do you propose to undercut that option?
Simple. We scare them.
You scare them?
She looked at me for a moment, and then coughed out a small, unwilling laugh.
Kovac, they should have you on disk. You're perfect post-trauma entertainment. So tell me, you're going to scare a corporate block? With what? Slasher puppets?
I felt a genuine smile twitch at my own lips. Something like that. Chapter 6. It took Schneider the better part of the next morning to wipe the shuttle's data core, while Tanya Wardani walked aimless, scuffing circles in the sand, or sat beside the open hatch and talked to him. I left them alone and walked up to the far end of the beach where there was a black rock headland. The rock proved simple to scale, and the view from the top was worth the few scrapes I picked up on the way. I leaned my back against a convenient outcrop and looked out to the horizon, recalling fragments of a dream from the previous night. Harlan's world is small for a habitable planet, and its seas slop about unpredictably under the influence of three moons. Sanction 4 is much larger, larger even than Latimer, or Earth, and it has no natural satellites, all of which makes for wide, placid oceans. Set against the memories of my early life on Harlan's world, this calm always seemed slightly suspicious, as if the sea were holding its watery breath, waiting for something cataclysmic to happen. It was a creepy sensation, and the envoy conditioning kept it locked down most of the time by the simple expedient of not allowing the comparison to cross my mind. In dream sleep, the conditioning is less effective, and evidently something in my head was worrying at the cracks. In the dream, I was standing on a shingle beach somewhere on Sanction 4, looking out at the tranquil swells, when the surface began to heave and swell. I watched, rooted to the spot, as mounds of water shifted and broke and flowed past each other like sinuous black muscles. What waves there were at the water's edge were gone, sucked back out to where the sea was flexing. A certainty made in equal parts of cold dread and aching sadness rose in me to match the disturbances offshore. I knew beyond a doubt something monstrous was coming up. But I woke up before it surfaced. A muscle twitched in my leg, and I sat up irritably. The dregs of the dream rinsed around the base of my mind, seeking connection with something more substantial. Maybe it was fallout from the duel with the smart minds. I'd watched the sea heave upward as our missiles detonated beneath the surface. Yeah, right. Very traumatic. My mind skittered through a few other recent combat memories, looking for a match. I stopped it rapidly. Pointless exercise. A year and a half of hands-on nastiness for Carrera's Wedge had laid up enough trauma in my head to give work to a whole platoon of psychosurgeons. I was entitled to a few nightmares. Without the envoy conditioning, I'd probably have suffered a screaming mental collapse months ago. And combat memories weren't what I wanted to look at right now. I made myself lie back again and relax into the day. The morning sun was already beginning to build towards semi-tropical midday heat, and the rock was warm to the touch. Between my half-closed eyelids, light moved the way it had in the lockside convalescent virtuality. I let myself drift. Time passed unused. My phone hummed quietly to itself. I reached down without opening my eyes and squeezed it active. Noted the increased weight of heat on my body, the light drenching of sweat on my legs. Ready to roll, said Schneider's voice. You still up on that rock?
I sat up unwillingly.
Yeah. You make the call yet?
All cleared. That mothballed scrambler uplink you stole? Beautiful. Crystal clear. They're waiting on us.
Be right down.
Inside my head, the same residue. The dream had not gone. Something coming up. I stowed the thought with the phone and started downward. Archaeology is a messy science. You'd think, with all the high-tech advances of the past few centuries, that we'd have the practice of robbing graves down to a fine art by now. After all, we can pick up the telltale traces of Martian civilization across interplanetary distances these days. Satellite surveys and remote sensing let us map their buried cities through meters of solid rock or hundreds of meters of sea. And we've even built machines that can make educated guesses about the more inscrutable remnants of what they left behind. With nearly half a millennium of practice, we really ought to be getting good at this stuff. But the fact is, no matter how subtle your detection science is, once you've found something, you've still got to dig it up. And with the vast capital investment the corporates have made in the race to understand the Martians, the digging is usually done with about as much subtlety as a crew night out in Madame Mee's Wharf Whore warehouse. There are fines to be made and dividends to be paid. And the fact that there are, apparently, no Martians around to object to the environmental damage doesn't help. The corporates swing in, rip the locks off the vacated worlds, and stand back while the archaeologue guilds swarm all over the fixtures. And when the primary sites have been exhausted, no one usually bothers to tidy up. You get places like Dig 27. Hardly the most imaginative name for a town, but there was a certain amount of accuracy in the choice. Dig 27 had sprung up around the excavation of the same name. Served for 50 years as dormitory, cafeteria, and leisure complex for the archaeologue workforce, and was now in steep decline as the seams of Xena culture ore panned out to the dregs. The original dig head was a gaunt, centipedal skeleton, straddling the skyline on stilled retrieval belts and awkwardly bent support struts as we flew in from the east. The town started beneath the drooping tail of the structure, and spread from it in sporadic and uncertain clumps like an unenthusiastic concrete fungus. Buildings rarely heaved themselves above five stories, and many of those that had were rather obviously derelict, as if the effort of upward growth had exhausted them beyond the ability to sustain internal life. Schneider banked around the skull end of the stalled dighead, flattened out, and floated down toward a piece of waste ground between three listing pylons that presumably delineated Dig 27's landing field. Dust boiled up from the badly kept ferrocrete as we hovered, and I saw jagged cracks blown naked by our landing brakes. Over the comset, a senile navigation beacon husked a request for identification. Schneider ignored it, knocked over the primaries, and climbed from his seat with a yawn.
End of the line, folks. Everybody out.
We followed him back to the main cabin and watched while he strapped on one of the unsubtle sawn-off particle throwers we'd liberated with a shuttle. He looked up, caught me watching, and winked.
I thought these were your friends.
Tanya Wardani was watching as well, alarmed, if the expression on her face was anything to go by. Schneider shrugged.
They were, he said, but you can't be too careful.
Oh, great. She turned to me. Have you got anything a bit less bulky than that cannon that I could maybe borrow? Something I can lift?
I lifted the edges of my jacket aside to show the two wedge-customized Kalashnikov interface guns where they rested in the chest harness. I'd lend you one of these, but they're personally coded.
Take a blaster, Tanya,
said Schneider without looking up from his own preparations.
More chance you'll hit something with it anyway. Slug throwers are for fashion victims.
The archaeologue raised her eyebrows. I smiled a little. He's probably right. Here, you don't have to wear it around your waist. The straps web out like this. Sling it over your shoulder. I moved to help her fit the weapon, and as she turned toward me, something indefinable happened in the small space between our bodies. I settled the holstered weapon at the downward slope of her left breast, and her eyes slanted upward to mine. They were, I saw, the color of jade under swift-flowing water. That comfortable?
Not especially.
I went to move the holster, and she raised a hand to stop me. Against the dusty ebony of my arm, her fingers looked like naked bones, skeletal and frail.
Leave it. It'll do.
Okay, look. You just pull down and the holster lets it go. Push back up and it grips again. Like that.
Got it.
The exchange had not been lost on Schneider. He cleared his throat loudly and went to crack the hatch. As it hinged outward, he held on to a hand grip at the leading edge and swung down with practiced flyer nonchalance. The effect was spoiled slightly as he landed and began coughing in the still settling dust our landing brake had raised. I suppressed a grin. Wardani went after him, letting herself down awkwardly with the heels of her palms on the floor of the open hatchway. Mindful of the dust clouds outside, I stayed in the hatchway, eyes narrowed against the airborne grit in an attempt to see if we had a reception committee. And we did. They emerged from the dust-like figures on a frieze, gradually sandblasted clean by someone like Tanya Wardani. I counted seven in all, bulky silhouettes swathed in desert gear and spiky with weapons. The central figure looked deformed, taller than the others by half a meter, but swollen and misshapen from the chest up. They advanced in silence. I folded my arms across my chest, so my fingertips touched the butts of the Kalashnikovs.
DeJoko?
Schneider coughed again.
That you, DeJoko?
More silence. The dust had settled enough for me to make out the dull glint of metal on gun barrels and the enhanced vision masks they all wore. There was room for body armor beneath the loose desert gear.
DeJoko, quit fucking around!
A high-pitched, impossible laugh from the towering, misshapen figure in the center. I blinked.
Chan! Chan, my good friend!
It was the voice of a child.
Do I make you so nervous?
What do you think, fuckwit?
Schneider stepped forward, and as I watched, the huge figure spasmed and seemed to break apart. Startled, I cranked up the Neurochem vision and made out a small boy of about eight scrambling down from the arms of the man who held him to his chest. As the boy reached the ground and ran to meet Schneider, I saw the man who had carried him straighten up into a peculiar immobility. Something quickened along the tendons in my arm. I screwed up my eyes some more and scanned the now unremarkable figure head to foot. This one was not wearing the EV mask, and his face was... I felt my mouth tighten as I realized what I was looking at. Schneider and the boy were trading complicated handshakes and spouting gibberish at each other. Midway through this ritual, the boy broke off and took Tanya Wardani's hand with a formal bow and some ornate flattery that I didn't catch. He seemed insistent on clowning his way through this meeting, this DeJoko. He was spouting harmlessness like a tinsel fountain on Harlan's day. And with the worst of the dust down where it belonged, the rest of the reception committee had lost the vague menace their silhouettes had given them. The clearing air revealed them as an assortment of nervous-looking and mostly young irregulars. I saw one wispy-bearded Caucasian on the left chewing his lip below the blank calm of the EV mask. Another was shifting from foot to foot. All of them had their weapons slung or stowed, and as I jumped down from the hatch, they all flinched backward. I raised my hands soothingly, shoulder height, palms outward.
Sorry.
Don't apologize to this idiot!
Schneider was now trying to cuff the boy around the back of the head, with limited success.
DeJoko, come here and say hello to a real live envoy. This is Takashi Kovach. He was at Inanen.
Indeed.
The boy came and offered his hand. Dark-skinned and fine-boned, it was already a handsome sleeve. In later life, it would be androgynously beautiful. It was dressed immaculately in a tailored mauve sarong and matching quilted jacket.
DeJoko Roes Pinoeji, at your service. I apologize for the drama, but one cannot be too careful in these uncertain times. Your call came in on satellite frequencies that no one outside Carrera's Wedge has access to, and Jan, while I love him like a brother, is not known for his connections in high places. It could have been a trap.
Mothballed scrambler uplink. Schneider said importantly. We stole it from the wedge. This time, DeJoko, when I say I'm jacked in, I mean it.
Who might be trying to trap you? I asked.
Ah.
The boy sighed with a world-weariness several decades out of place in his voice.
There is no telling. Government agencies, the cartel, corporate leverage analysts, Kempist spies. None of them has any reason to love DeJoko or Espinoeji. Remaining neutral in a war does not save you from making enemies as it should. Rather, it loses you any friends you might have and earns you suspicion and contempt from all sides.
The war isn't this far south yet,
Ordani pointed out. DeJoko Roespinoeji placed a hand gravely on his chest.
For which we are all extremely grateful. But these days not being on the front line merely means you are under occupation of one form or another. Landfall is barely 800 kilometers to our west. We are close enough to be considered a perimeter post, which means a state militia garrison and periodic visits from the cartel's political assessors.
He sighed again.
It's all very costly.
I looked at him suspiciously.
Your garrison? Where are they?
Over there.
The boy jerked a thumb at the ragged group of irregulars.
Oh, there are a few more back at the uplink bunker, as per regulations, but essentially what you see here is the garrison.
That's the state militia? Asked Tanya Wardani.
It is.
Roespinoeji looked sadly at them for a moment, then turned back to us.
Of course, when I said it was costly, I was referring mostly to the cost of making the political assessor's visits congenial. For us and for him, that is. The assessor is not a very sophisticated man, but he does have substantial appetites. And, of course, ensuring that he remains our political assessor displaces a certain amount of expenditure, too. Generally, they are rotated every few months.
Is he here now?
I would hardly have invited you here if he was. He left only last week.
The boy leered, unnerving to watch in a face that young.
Satisfied, you might say, with what he found here?
I found myself smiling. I couldn't help it.
I think we've come to the right place.
Well, that will depend on what you came for,
said Roespinoeji, glancing at Schneider.
Jan was far from explicit, but come, even in Dig 27 there are more congenial places than this to discuss business.
He led us back to the little group of waiting militiamen and made a sharp clucking sound with his tongue. The figure who had been carrying him before stooped awkwardly and picked him up. Behind me, I heard Tanya Wardani's breath catch slightly as she saw what had been done to the man. It was by no means the worst thing I'd ever seen happen to a human being. Wasn't, in fact, even the worst I'd seen recently. Still, there was something eerie about the ruined head and the silvery alloy cement that had been used to patch it together. If I'd had to guess, I would have said this sleeve had been struck by flying shrapnel. Any kind of deliberate, directional weapon just wouldn't have left you anything to work with. But someone somewhere had taken the trouble to repair the dead man's skull, seal up the remaining gaps with resin, and replace the eyeballs with photoreceptors that sat in the gutted sockets like cycloptic silver spiders waiting for prey. Then, presumably, they'd coaxed enough life back into the brainstem to operate the body's vegetative systems and basic motor functions, and maybe respond to a few programmed commands. Back before I got shot up on the rim, I'd had a wedge non-com working with me whose Afro-Caribbean sleeve was actually his own. One night, waiting out a satellite bombardment in the ruins of some kind of temple, he told me one of the myths of his people, in chains, had taken across an ocean on Earth, and later, in the hope of a new beginning, across the gulfs of the Martian astrogation charts to the world that would later become known as Latimer. It was a story of magicians and the slaves they made of bodies raised from the dead. I forget what name he gave to these creatures in the story, but I know he would have seen one and the thing that held the Joko Roespinoeji in his arms.
Do you like it?
The boy, cuddled up obscenely close to the ravaged head, had been watching me. Not much, no.
Well, aesthetically, of course.
The boy let his voice trail off delicately.
but with judicious use of bandaging and some suitably ragged clothing for me, we should make a truly pitiful ensemble. The wounded and the innocent, fleeing from the ruins of their shattered